Hello, everyone. I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to Season 7 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
Today on Archive Fever, we're speaking to someone with a very big job indeed, looking after an archive of no less than 1.5 million objects. Alison Vaughan is the collections manager of the National Herbarium of Victoria, a vast treasure trove of botanical specimens that is also the oldest scientific institution, oldest settler institution that is, in the state of Victoria. The herbarium was established way back in 1853 by Ferdinand von Mueller, the first government botanist of Victoria, and today it's part of the Royal Botanic Gardens. The herbarium's collection includes dried plants, algae and fungi specimens, about half of which were collected before 1900. It's Alison's responsibility to look after this huge archive of botanical and historical material, and she's clearly the perfect person for the job. With a background in botany, history, Indigenous studies and communications, Alison is passionate about using stories to connect people and plants. She's also an expert in Australian botanical history, where she's working to uncover the contribution of First Peoples and women to botanical science. Alison, welcome to Archive Fever.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honour to be here.
Alison, you've clearly got many strings to your bow. History and botany, science and storytelling, plus a huge archive under your watch to boot. You're clearly quite a big nerd, which in this space is about the highest compliment we can give.
Thank you very much.
Can you take us back to where this nerdery all began? How did you first get the research bug and get interested in archives?
I think it probably goes back about 30 years when I was studying a VCE Revolutions subject. I grew up in Gippsland, so I was based there, but your research opportunities in Gippsland aren't a little bit limited. So I would make what felt like a pilgrimage, really, to the State Library of Victoria. So catching the train down and then the tram up Swanston Street to the library. And then I think just being absorbed by the atmosphere of the library, surrounded by those walls of books and the smell of them, the little murmuring noises of the library was just enchanting. And for that French Revolution subject, there was one book I kept going back to. It was actually in the rare books room, and it was a first person narrative of sort of life in revolutionary France, and I cannot remember who wrote it or absolutely anything about it, but that experience, especially going into the rare books room where you've got that sort of extra layer of sanctity to the space, that just drew me in. And yeah, I fell for the archive hard.
Snap, soul sister, that's my story too. Year 12, State Library of Victoria, manuscript section.
Yeah, yep.
And might have been there at the same time.
I think I'm older, but just from your little countdown there.
Yeah.
But same journey, feeling very nostalgic here.
Yeah, and it really transformed the path that I took, because I had always assumed I would study science and always interested in biological sciences, but having...
Well, that's where our similarity ends.
Well, having sort of fallen for the archive, I couldn't let go. And so rather than study straight sciences, I did an arts degree as well as a science degree.
And then where did your career take you from there? How did you go from studying arts and science to ending up as the manager of the herbarium collection?
It was very serendipitous, really. Yeah. I was really very keen to do an honours and continue an academic career. But I couldn't decide between whether I wanted to study seabirds or post-colonial Australian history. And I was taking the time to try and make that terrible decision. I was very torn between those things. And I was actually looking for, I think my boyfriend at the time and my aunt were both looking for jobs. And it was, you know, when you had to get the Saturday Age and trawl through it. Mm. And it's such a soul-destroying thing. I thought, I'll look for jobs, less taxing on me. And then I came across this ad for a job at the herbarium that was cataloguing specimens for the Australasian Virtual Herbarium Project. And I was like, oh, there's a job for me. So I applied and I got the job and I'm still there 21 years later.
And you never did the honours?
Never did the honours.
The birds are left unstudied?
No, I like to look at them, but yeah.
I was going to suggest you could have combined the two by looking at seabirds as a kind of motif in Australian colonial history or something on those lines.
That would have been quite ahead of its time in a way, that cross-disciplinary or post-colonial way of viewing cultural knowledge and knowledge in general is much more of the honours thesis that we're seeing coming through now.
So you clearly made a good decision in applying and taking that job at the herbarium if you're still there all these years later. What was it about it that seduced you? Did you have that same sense of intoxication going into the herbarium that you got at the State Library during VCE?
I did, possibly even more, because working with specimens, and back then when I was cataloguing, databasing the specimens, you don't know what you're about to look at. I guess you have a folder of specimens in front of you, and each time you would open up a folder to see what it was, you had no idea whether it was going to be something collected 2 years ago or 200 years ago or who by. And I think one of the most tantalising things about the herbarium as a botanical archive is its incompleteness, in that to maximise the scientific utility of the specimens, then we actually have to do all of this detective work and fill in the gaps. We would sort of delve, I guess, from the herbarium as a starting point and head off into all sorts of different rabbit holes, into different archives, to try and find the missing pieces that would make the specimen more useful.
I've got a couple of establishment questions, because I realise as you're talking that I haven't got an image in my mind of, like, when you go to work, what it looks like. I know what it looks like to walk into the public records office or to the State Library, and I know what boxes of paper on shelves look like, but I don't have a sense of what 1.5 million objects in a herbarium look like. So just walk us through, paint us a picture of how that is actually physically structured and organised.
Yeah. Well, each specimen itself is about A3 in size. So think of if you went out and snipped a bit off a plant, pressed it, you'd do it in a very scientific way, of course, but pressed it and then mounted it onto an A3 archival card. It would have a label in the right-hand corner that's sort of inset about with a little border around the edge, and that label would ideally tell you where and when something was collected, who by, where it was growing, other plants it was growing with, information about the environment.
So generally what we might call provenance?
Provenance, yes. Yeah. The more information a collector records, the better the specimen is. We might come back to how that's not always the case. From then, the specimens are organised systematically, so by the relationships between the plant families. Mm-hmm. So they're filed away in metal cabinets by family and then alphabetically by genus and species. So walking into the herbarium is like walking into a bit of a cavernous space with rows and rows of metal cabinets, each one with a plant family name on the front of the cupboard. And then if you open that up, you're seeing shelves of specimens stored in large manila folders flat on the shelves.
So in that sense, it's the scientific method that structures the collection, not more of an historical method that's based in chronology, where you might have everything that Ferdinand von Mueller collected in 1850s. And so it's not based in that way, which is why, as you said earlier, you can open a folder and there's something that was collected 2 weeks ago as opposed to 200 years ago, and they might be right next to each other.
Absolutely. And that arrangement of the collection obviously supports the scientific use of the collection very well, but it's not just a scientific collection, it's a cultural and historical collection. And it can make it very time consuming when you actually want to do some of that social history research on the collection, because you're not going to one place, you're going to potentially thousands of different locations to find things collected by a single person.
And forgive my ignorance on this question, but, you know, as someone who does not know a lot about botany, I can't quite get my head around that plant specimens that are nearly 200 years old, you know, haven't crumbled into dust. I mean, do they need specific environmental conditions, levels of humidity and temperature to survive, or are they pretty resilient?
They're pretty resilient. The oldest specimen that we know of in our collection is about 500 years old.
Oh.
And it's in very good shape.
What is that and where does it come from?
It's an aquatic moss that we think is probably from Switzerland, kind of area. It doesn't have a locality on it, but we know it's from the herbarium of Caspar Bohan, who was a Swiss botanist.
Do we know how it came to be in Australia and in this collection?
Do, yes. So Ferdinand Müller, in establishing the herbarium in Melbourne, was very keen. He wanted reference material from not only all around this continent, but from all around the world. Because if you're trying to understand the flora of a place, you need to do that in a global context, because the relationships between plants span continents. They ignore political boundaries that we impose on them. And one of the collections that Müller was very keen to acquire was the herbarium of the private collector Otto Sonder. Well, actually, I should call him Wilhelm Sonder. He was a German chemist and botanist, and he was a colleague of Müller's, a contemporary of Müller's. They were corresponded a lot and could be considered friends. When Sonder got around to wanting to pass on his herbarium or get rid of his herbarium, he really wanted Müller to be able to acquire it. And Müller spent 2 decades convincing the then Port Phillip government that they should pay for it. And then in 1883, it came to Melbourne. So it's really an extraordinary collection. And at the time when Müller was petitioning the government to purchase it, he described it as the richest of all private herbaria in existence. And from what we know of it, that's absolutely true. It's got specimens like the one we talked about, the 500-year-old moss. It's got specimens from the earliest European explorations of Southern America and Africa, and from Canadian Arctic and all over the place. And it's got all these specimens collected on imperial voyages. And so it's a real historical document as well as scientific archived record of the world's botanical history.
I'm interested in that connection between, I guess, botanical science and empire, because, you know, it's obviously tempting to think of botany is apolitical, but we know that that form of science, as other forms of knowledge production, was deeply connected with the work of empire and, you know, with Europeans kind of knowing the rest of the world and dominating it. Can you tell us a bit how those dynamics worked maybe in relation to the Victorian herbarium? I mean, what was von Müller doing in relation to the colonisation of Victoria at the time, and do you see the herbarium today as kind of part of the colonial project?
Absolutely. It's absolutely an colonial institution. Mm. And one of the things I find really interesting about the herbarium is it's the product of colonisation, but because colonialism has wrought so much environmental damage, it's also the foundation of knowledge that will help us remedy some of those environmental ills. So it's really, it's got that, I guess, that tension there between the different aspects of colonisation, the good and the bad. In terms of what Müller was doing, all his correspondence is available online, but I haven't read it, so I'm probably not the best person to talk about his views on colonisation. But Müller's herbarium in Victoria was very much the centre of colonial botany in Australia. And because of that, specimens from most of those early European exploring expeditions came to Melbourne. Many went to London, but many had duplicates or just the whole collection came to us in Melbourne. So we have those bits of evidence. Mm. And one of the things we're trying to do very much in the collection is uncover some of those hidden hands. So you mentioned First Peoples and women, and those First Peoples contributions are particularly difficult to uncover because they were never acknowledged in the first place. And so there's a lot more reading between the lines. And that's very much the case for some of the imperial exploring expeditions, where the survival of those expeditions was truly dependent on the Aboriginal guides, who get very little, if any, credit at all. On the specimens that came from those expeditions, there's never an Aboriginal person's name on there. It's always the exploring party leader whose name is on there and who gets the heroics for the success of those expeditions and for discovering knowledge that has existed for tens of thousands of years.
On that theme of the herbarium and its collection being an imperial legacy, I'm thinking about other imperial legacy collections that end up in museums, in particularly human remains, and the moves that are made towards repatriation of those remains now. They are a big responsibility for modern museums, and museums don't tend to consider themselves to be the owners of those remains now, of the ancestors, but custodians and caretakers of them. Do you feel a similar sense of responsibility towards some of the plants? And is there any kind of parallel move towards repatriation of specimens to return them to country?
That's a great question, and it's something that, as I guess, herbaria have come to a lot later than museums, because for museums, the understanding that you have ancestral remains or cultural objects is a lot more tangible. People don't think or haven't historically thought of herbaria as cultural collections. But of course, every specimen from this continent has been collected on country. Some of them are more explicitly cultural specimens in that they might have Indigenous cultural knowledge on the labels, or very few we have been able to determine that it was collected by an Aboriginal person for the 19th century ones, which gives them that extra layer of culture. But in terms of repatriation, we haven't had any requests for specimens to be returned to country. I think that's probably at this stage very much a reflection of the fact that people don't know what herbaria are, or that they exist, or that they can be conceived of as having cultural specimens within them. What we are doing, though, is trying to connect those specimens back to country in different ways. So a lot of herbaria have moved towards large-scale digitization of their collections, which is, of course, one way of virtual repatriation, even though it assumes a whole lot of technological capability and internet access. In terms of Indigenous cultural knowledge on the labels, at this point, we aren't able to repatriate that because we have Indigenous cultural knowledge from maybe dozens of different language groups around the continent. It's too big a burden on us, but more importantly, it's too big a burden on those communities to maintain and establish those trusting relationships that allow us to have the dialogue about repatriation or about custodianship in ways that just is feasible. So one of the things I'm really interested in is a collaboration between not only biological collections, herbaria and zoological museums, but right across the GLAM sector, of having a process that makes this easier not only for the collecting institutions, but even more so for community, to have a single point where they can go to and find out what of their cultural knowledge is housed in what collections. Because you can imagine a community might have cultural knowledge stored in hundreds of different collections all around the world. And the burden of trying to maintain those relationships is far too great.
So you're saying some kind of digital database, these kinds of collections that are non-documentary, non-archival in that traditional sense.
I think so. And whether it's a single database or whether it's the different disciplinary databases having the right flags, the big question for us is where you fall on the line between making it available, publicly available, so it can be discovered, and protecting it so it can't be exploited. And where we're sitting with that at the moment is it is captured in our collections management system, but we don't make it publicly available. So all of our collecting data when we catalogue specimens is shared via the Australasian Virtual Herbarium and through that to the Global Biodiversity Information Facility. So these are big data aggregators, but we don't share that information at this stage. It does contain medicinal plant use information that's likely secret, sacred knowledge. So we're erring on the side of protecting those things from exploitation while we seek to find a feasible way to connect that information back to the communities or establish relationships with the rightful knowledge holders of that information so they can make the decisions about if and how it should be shared.
I imagine that many of the specimens were collected on Kulin country in what we call Victoria. I mean, does the herbarium have any sort of relationships with Wurundjeri or other Kulin nations to kind of grapple with these sorts of questions?
Yeah, we do. Some of them are still emerging. Some of them are more established than others. So we've got good relationships with Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and Bunurong because we also have Cranbourne Gardens on Bunurong country. When we undertake field work across the state, because, you know, it's not a static collection, it's a collection that gets added to weekly, our field botanists, they'll try and get in touch with local traditional owners, talk about the work we're doing, see if their natural resources teams want to come collecting with us and try and provide opportunities for two-way knowledge exchange. We talked about how on the label, the name on the label is not going to be an Aboriginal person. So it's through some of that digging, through some of that detective work that we can uncover some of those hidden hands. And one specimen in particular that I'm thinking of was collected in southwest Western Australia, and the blue herbarium label on it, so Mueller had his own little blue herbarium labels printed. The name on that is Webb, William Webb, who was actually an ex-convict and professional natural history collector. He had a curio shop, made his living by collecting and selling natural history specimens. How we know that that specimen wasn't actually collected by Webb is that there was a letter accompanying it, and in it, Webb writes that this specimen was collected by my wife's friend, Lucy Eads, and Webb's son, which in itself doesn't tell you anything. But through the process of trying to give identities to the women who have contributed to the collection in trying to quantify the involvement of women in science, we found out that William Webb was married to an Aboriginal woman who is also named Lucy, and that her friend Lucy Eads, they were both Menang Noongar women. And so it was only because that letter was there that we could look at this and see that, well, this was collected by an Aboriginal woman and an Aboriginal child. And what that prompts us to think about is, well, how many of the hundreds of specimens collected by Webb or attributed to Webb were actually collected by Aboriginal people.
And women. That aspect of the gendered nature of the hidden hands really fascinates me, because when I was reading about your work in preparing for the interview, I couldn't help but thinking about a book, a novel that I read a couple of years ago that I really loved, which was The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert, which is about a 19th century fictional female botanist. Mm-hmm. And she goes on a spiritual journey. So here's Elizabeth Gilbert, and this is a bit of a woo question for you. The character in that goes on a spiritual journey, and it's one that's very linked to her own personal growth and her development and transformation as a woman through her global study of moss, funnily enough, with your 500-year-old moss. It made me wonder whether you consider that there is a spiritual dimension to your work as well as a scientific and a social element to it?
I think in the sense that the world around us is spiritual. It feeds our souls as much as plants and algae and fungi clothe us and feed us and house us. They do also feed our souls. They're essential for our emotional, mental well-being as well. So in that sense, yes, it is spiritual work. One of the things, coming back to that idea of that imperial science and the application of, I guess, imperial knowledge on landscapes that already had very rich ways of knowing and understanding and relating to plants, the thing that I find unifying, whether the motivation for collecting these specimens was imperial, political, whatever the motivation was, generally the people who are collecting them are deeply passionate and inspired by the world around them and what they're collecting. And that sense, that coming sense of the unifying joy, the unifying reliance on plants and algae and fungi that comes through the collection as we work with these specimens that have been collected over hundreds of years, that to me is really powerful.
Now, as we've been talking about, a lot of the collection was collected before 1900 or, you know, in some cases even 500 years ago. As we know, the environment has changed significantly since then, largely due to colonisation in Australia at least. Are any of the species in the collection now extinct or at risk of becoming extinct?
Very much so. Yeah, they are. We do have specimens of species that are understood to be extinct from not having been collected for however many decades or seen in the wild. That botanical archive, it's an archive of past biodiversity.
Yeah.
And present biodiversity. And one of the really interesting things about that is it allows us to predict future biodiversity. And so with each specimen being a record, a piece of evidence of the existence of an organism at a particular place and time, and we keep collecting, we don't just have one specimen of a species. We want to continue collecting through time and through space to make sure that we get that big picture of biodiversity through time. And what that picture allows us to do is to track changes. So we can see how flowering and fruiting times might change for a species over decades or centuries. We can see how the chemical composition of the leaf tissue might change, and that will tell us about the environment the plant was growing in, perhaps pollution levels in the soil or the air. We can take DNA from the specimens and see what genetic changes are happening over time and correlate them with environmental change. And we can do things like the information on when and where a specimen was collected. When we catalogue that, we map that locality as precisely as we can. Once digitised, all of those specimens of a single species give us the fundamental distribution map that tells us where something grows. Mm. And the thing is, it's verifiable. So if mistakes are made, which they are, if ideas of species change, we can go back to it, verify it, update it. And so that geospatial information about where these different species grows allows us to do some environmental modelling. We can see what the environmental parameters of different species are now. And using climate change models, we can see, well, what's going to happen to the ideal environment? What's the suitable habitat for that species 20, 50, 70 years into the future? So it allows us to plan and prioritise.
Yeah. And how do you increase the collection in that sense? How does your garden grow? Is it an element of citizen science? Can I take a clipping from my backyard and bring it into you? Or do you have specific specimen collectors now and that you know that you're looking for certain things that are going to be able to augment your maps? Mm-hmm. How does that work?
It's a bit of a mix of targeted collecting and serendipitous collecting. So definitely you can collect something in your own backyard because you don't need a permit for it, but you can't just go out into a national park and start collecting things and sending them in to us. So most of our collecting is done by our seed bank botanists. So as well as the herbarium, we have another amazing biological archive of seeds and spores of Victoria's most rare and threatened plants. And that serves as an insurance against extinction. So we've got something there that can regenerate those populations if bushfires is the most likely thing, wipes out an entire population. So our seed bank botanists, in going out and collecting for the seed bank and the spore bank, they'll always collect a specimen as well, because you need that verifiable reference point. We have a network of associates of the gardens. Some are retired botanical consultants, retired botanists, not always retired, but mostly, who will collect specimens. They don't just collect sort of anything. They'll generally collect things that they know are of particular interest. But we don't only want novel finds. It's important that we have a good representation geographically, taxonomically, and temporally of everything, because that's what allows us to track the changes to species through time. Periodically, we will have a big targeted collecting trip for an underrepresented part of the state. Herbaria exchange specimens between them, so we will tend to collect duplicates, which you can't really do with animals so much, but you can with specimens, with plants. And we will send exchange specimens to other herbaria. So that boosts their reference collections for their understanding of the flora. Periodic donations. So in the last few years, we've had received the life's work of a couple of really important phycologists, so algae experts, as they're, you know, in their 80s, ready to hand over their life's work. And so that's tens of thousands of specimens.
So this is personal, essentially personal archives become public archives.
They do, yeah. And for me, that's one of the real thrills of working with the collection, is you become the custodian of someone's life's work, of their passion. It's such a privilege to do that.
And I know the herbarium also welcomes researchers. I'm fascinated about what that looks like, because, you know, I'm used to going to research at a kind of documentary archive, but I wonder who goes to research in a herbarium. Is it botanists, other scientists, historians, all of the above?
All of the above. Most of our researchers are taxonomists, so people who are trying to understand the boundaries between different species, understand how their different species are related to each other. Like, you would go into archives and manuscripts as the primary sources for historical research. The botanical specimens are the primary sources for taxonomic research. Mm. And so every time someone describes a species or decides that what we've previously thought of as three species is actually just one with a bit of perhaps geographic variation, all those things that annoy people, they have to base those decisions and that understanding on herbarium specimens. What it looks like when a taxonomist comes in is that they come in, they'll sit at a desk, usually with a microscope or two. They will have a stack of specimens and they will look at them one by one. They will often measure characters and make these matrices of the different characters, trying to sort out, well, are they all the same species? Are they different? They will update the specimens, which is a really key difference of most archival research, where you don't write on the specimens.
Yes,
and
they're
don't
kind
add
of being
anything
the
to
researcher
them.
And the archivist at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, they are. So they might re-identify a specimen. Mm-hmm. They might think it's been incorrectly identified. So they'll have a little annotation slip that they'll write their opinion on what species this is on the top. They'll put their name and they'll date it, and that gets stuck onto the sheets. They'll also might add annotations that help us improve our understanding of the specimen. For a specimen to function as a useful scientific research, we do need to be able to pinpoint it to that particular place and time. But generally, the older a specimen is, the less likely it is to have comprehensive collecting information. Sometimes we'll just have a handwritten scribble. Sometimes it's just a number. But through our detective work, we might get to know, well, whose handwriting that is. We might be able to decode that number. We might be able to figure out, well, that was collected by Johann Price, and he was only in Western Australia between 1839 and 1843. So we can't always get really precise with those times and dates, but we can narrow things down to improve their scientific usability. And in that process, we leave records for future users of the specimen. And while they're increasingly just going into those kinds of annotations just into digital form, it's still very often appropriate to put a physical annotation on the specimen. For me, that's another one of these thrills, this idea of the collection is the work of many hands over many generations, and we're not just preserving these specimens intact as they once were, we're adding to them and evolving them.
Now I'm imagining different taxonomists all arguing about it, the nature of a species, and writing their little annotations on top of each other.
Yeah, it's botany is
like Talmudic scholars.
Yes.
It's a fairly friendly discipline, so we don't get too many battles of the annotation slip, but I think it can happen from time to time.
Alison, taking us right back to where we started to bookend this interview, you were talking about your own life as a researcher and how you weren't sure whether you wanted to write about birds or about history. I'm wondering what you, all these years later, call yourself now. Do you consider yourself to be an archivist or a curator or a scientist or an historian? How would you label yourself in the taxonomy of disciplines?
It's a good question, and I think I'd go with curator because it's the vaguest. I'm certainly no botanist. I am much better at identifying handwriting than plants. But I feel like I don't quite deserve the title historian, but there's plenty of historic research that I do. So I'd, sort of tack on as a...
We reckon you can complain.
Yeah.
Well, as a curator come historian, it's time to ask you the question we ask all our guests on Archive Fever. Do you have a dirty little archive secret you'd be willing to share with us?
There's a few.
Ooh.
But they're not things I've done. I think my biggest dirty secret for something that I've done in a collection is it's so easy to get sidetracked. And sometimes I'll see something that's been poorly curated that really needs fixing, but I'll just pretend I didn't see it. Very occasionally.
How dare you?
We do sometimes come across other people's dirty secrets when we're doing that detective work to figure out, you know, who a person was, where it was collected. And I can't remember what the prompt was, but I was looking into the life of Edward Reader, who was an English plant collector for Mueller. I came across this book by Cyril Pearl, I think it was written in the 70s, called Five Men Vanished. And it was about the disappearance of five men in Bermagui in 1880. They were presumed to be murdered. The mystery of their disappearance was never solved. But Edward Reader was implicated in it. So he disappeared from Bermagui Tilba around the same time. He trashed his house before he left and destroyed a whole lot of things. He was later on a train journey with someone who just struck up a casual conversation and happened to mention this disappearance, this mystery. And apparently Edward Reader got very cagey and very defensive and shut down the conversation. So the implication that one of our 30,000 botanical collectors has been involved in the disappearance of five people in this 150-year-old unsolved
mystery. The raw material for a great murder mystery.
Yeah. Right. Send that one Elizabeth Gilbert's way, see what she does with that.
But I think what that tells me is that we generally think of it a very gentle science and people who love plants as being very gentle, but I guess it goes back to that thing that plants are so relevant for everyone that you have this enormous diversity of people who collect them.
Even potential murderers.
Even that.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Alison.
To learn more about Alison's work, follow her on LinkedIn. You can also check out the National Herbarium of Victoria website, or if you're in Naarm, head along for a visit.
You can follow Claire on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Reese. And don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1 through 6 via the website archivefeverpod.com. And you can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to listen.
And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a rating or review. So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
coming up on the next episode.